Good afternoon. We're going to start the afternoon session of the commission for the 13th of September, 2019. We are on item number 7, Blue Sheet Corn Pond Hunting. This is a briefing. Kyle?
Good afternoon. My name is Kyle Spriggins. I am the waterfowl section manager in the game division, based out of Olympia. Today's presentation is a policy briefing at the request of a blue sheet related to the term corn pond policy. Corn ponds is a description that's often used within the hunting community to describe what it would be legally described as hunting over flooded standing crop. So today I will be providing a policy briefing on that topic. And So in providing this briefing, I think it's important to touch on a review of where the baiting in relation to migratory game birds as it applies to Washington, how we've gotten to the current state of what that regulatory language says, the process that went through to align both the state with the federal regulations related to this topic. Provide details of the WAC 220-416-100, that's the baiting of game birds unlawful, and then actually describe what is legal and what is illegal, and then provide a summary of what occurred at the Waterfowl Advisory Group discussion on Saturday, April 13th, 2019. So it's important to draw attention to that prior to 2012, the state and the federal language was not actually in parallel. During a September 2009 presentation to the commission by both department and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service enforcement agents, following that presentation, the commission had made a request to the department to align both the state and federal language regarding baiting regulations to reflect the Title 50 CFR, the Federal Register language that touches on this topic. This was because of several issues, but primarily because of the problematic nature of enforcement related to that discrepancy between language, that waterfowl hunters were confused by what was and what was not considered baiting and baited areas, but also that landowners were being found to unknowingly be in violation of the federal law based on practices that they were undertaking on their lands. So during the 2012-2015 three-year season setting process, there was extensive outreach, including with farmers by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service agents, that highlighted that many farmers were unaware that their planting, harvest, and post-harvest practices constituted illegal baiting of waterfowl. So during the April 2012, Commission adopted what is now WAC 220-416-100 with the amendments that provided this alignment. In front of each of you, I've provided our annual regulatory pamphlet for waterfowl and upland game hunting, but also bookmarked on page 48 is the federal pamphlet related to waterfowl hunting and baiting that was mentioned this morning by the public input. These two, the language now, because of that action in April 2012, are very parallel in language, and that consistency is nationwide. This is due to that shared management responsibility of migratory birds, birds that are coming from Alaska, Canada, Russia, through our state and on further south as far as Mexico. What it boils down to are there are four terminologies in this language that are the focal point of this regulation, and that has to do with planting, harvesting, post-harvest manipulation, and soil stabilization practices. These four items are what are explicitly called out, and I'm going to provide you with the actual wording that's in these, particularly in our WAC, and provide some of those definitions and clarify why those four are that focus. So on page 48, but from WAC 220-416-100, it reads, it is unlawful to hunt game birds by the aid of baiting on or over any baited area or on or over any area posted as an upland bird feeding site where a person knows or reasonably should know that the area has been baited. So for this, the term baiting itself means the direct or indirect placing, exposing, depositing, distributing, or scattering of salt, grain, or other feed that could serve as a lure or attraction for game birds to, on, or over areas where hunters are attempting to take them. The key piece of that is it has to be food that can be consumed. Sort of the extreme version of that is plastic yellow corn cobs would not be, that's not something that can be consumed. As an extension, this then reaches to an area. So not only the action or the activity of baiting, but the actual site definition of a baited area means any area on which salt, grain, or other feed has been placed, exposed, deposited, distributed, or scattered if that salt, grain, or other feed could serve as a lure or attraction for game birds to, on, or over areas where hunters are attempting to take them. Any such area will remain a baited area for 10 days following the complete removal of all such salt, grain, or other feed. The other important piece to point out here is this is about when a firearm comes into the picture. There is nothing that says feeding of the wildlife is what is wrong. It's when a firearm enters into that equation. This 10 days, this 10-day rule requires the complete removal of any such baiting item before it can be considered a illegal to hunt again. There's two other definitions that are important to point out. The first is manipulation, which means the alteration of natural vegetation or agricultural crops by activities that include but are not limited to mowing, shredding, disking, rolling, chopping, trampling, flattening, burning, or herbicide treatments. The term manipulation does not include the distributing or scattering of grain, seed, or other feed after removal from or storage on the field where grown. Natural vegetation means any non-agricultural, native, or naturalized plant species that grows at a site in response to planting or from existing seeds or other propagules. The term natural vegetation does not include planted millet. However, planted millet that grows on its own in subsequent years after the year of planting is considered natural vegetation. In other words, that first year where seed is scattered, it's a crop. Any subsequent year where it's coming from the seed bank itself, it's natural vegetation. And that's important because there are activities that are promoting the growth of something like millet in wetland situations. So in these three items, this is where those terms sort of come together. So the normal agricultural operation means a normal agricultural planting, harvesting, post-harvest manipulation, or agricultural practice that is conducted in accordance with the official recommendations of state extension specialists of the Cooperative Extension Service of the USDA. So these are individuals that are placed around the state, often county-specific or zone-specific, but they are the ones that are have recommendations for certain crops, such as planting date or other practices that might be common to that specific region or something that's used elsewhere. Normal agricultural planting, harvesting, or post-harvest manipulation means a planting or harvesting undertaken for the purpose of producing and gathering a crop, or manipulation after such harvest and removal of the grain that is conducted in accordance with, again, the state extension specialists. What's important to point out there is it's about the activity and the mechanism around it, not the intent. There is nothing about intent of the crop, and that's very clearly articulated further in the federal, but it is about the mechanism. Is the tractor and the equipment used during those operations normal? Normal soil stabilization practices means a planting for agricultural soil erosion control or post-mining land reclamation conducted in accordance with official recommendations of, again, the state extension specialists. So with all that, what is legal? So what is legal are standing crops or flooded standing crops, including aquatics, standing, flooded, or manipulated natural vegetation, flooded harvested crop lands, or lands or areas where seeds or grains have been scattered solely as the result of normal agricultural planting, harvesting, post-harvest manipulation, or normal soil stabilization practice. Two, from a blind or other place of concealment camouflaged with natural vegetation. Three, from a blind or other place of concealment camouflaged with vegetation from agricultural crops, as long as such camouflaging does not result in the exposing, depositing, distributing, or scattering of grain or other feed. And finally, standing or flooded standing agricultural crops where grain is inadvertently scattered solely as a result of a hunter entering or exiting a hunting area, placing decoys, or retrieving downed birds. Of course, that last one can go too far in certain circumstances, and that is something that's stressed in the law enforcement training. But in general, the typical hunting activity of trying to go and get downed birds is not... That is legal. So what is illegal? Illegal is unharvested crops that have been trampled by livestock or subjected to those manipulations that were listed that distribute, scatter, or expose grain. Two, areas where grain or seed has been top sown and the Cooperative Extension Service does not recommend that practice of top sowing, including in cases of freshly planted wildlife food plots that contain exposed grain. Again, with that, the recommendation of the Cooperative Extension Service. Three, croplands where a crop has been harvested and removed grain is redistributed or added back onto the area where grown, again, producing exposed grain that has been redistributed out there. And finally, areas where grain is present and stored, such as grain elevators, grain bins, and livestock feeding areas. A perfect example of that is we have waterfowl closures along stretches of the Columbia River and the Snake River that explicitly that are closed because of that that concentration of grain during the loading of barges and that activity. So we have areas closed to not put hunters in a illegal situation. Yeah.
Mr. Thorburn?
Point number four, what about upland birds? And what is the area?
This is specific to the migratory waterfowl.
Okay.
There are different rules as it applies to dove, and that's about as far as I can speak to. But there are different nuances in terms of dove hunting.
Okay.
But in terms of the on point number. On one of these points, it was talking about the adjacent to upland. There's other types of hunting where scattering a grain or that might be allowed, but in that case, the knowing or reasonably should know, a waterfowl hunter shouldn't be entering that situation where it might be legal for one species, but it's very clearly not allowed for waterfowl hunting.
I'd just like to say I think some of us would be fine if your Asian collared dove were taken.
Yeah. Agreed.
The other part I wanted to point out in relation to this slide was there are certain circumstances that are out there on the landscape that are, you know, go beyond even sometimes what might have been tried to be captured or described. For example, one of the issues that has come up several times in talking with some of the federal law enforcement and our own law enforcement are cases with corn mazes. Nothing about the planting is illegal. Nothing about the circumstance is illegal. It's when it comes time to take down the corn maze. If you go through and mow down the corn maze, you've suddenly created a baited area. Now, again, there's nothing wrong with feeding the animals. It's when a firearm comes into the situation and you're talking about waterfowl hunting. So it's not necessarily the site itself, but the adjacent clubs then are actually in a zone of influence and could be in these, would be considered in these baited areas. And there have been circumstances where clubs have been asked to cease until whether they go through and pick it all up 10 days later after that. So anyway, there's different sort of circumstances that are out there on the landscape that do create problematic situations. So again, that consistency in trying to parallel the language between both our state and that federal regulation revolves around those four terms: that planting, harvesting, post-harvest manipulation, soil stabilization practice. It's about how grain is getting to the ground and the activities that that surround a farmer's means of accomplishing those tasks. During the Waterfowl Advisory Group meeting, so back a year ago, September 2018, I was given the directive to put that discussion in front of the Waterfowl Advisory Group. That group is made up of currently 17 individuals from around the state. There's usually a very clear half-west, half-east split to that group. It is a combination of many different individuals, ties with Ducks Unlimited, Washington Waterfowl Association. It tends to be that there's very clear communications between that individual and some sort of local chapter or group. But it is a group that has 3-year terms, and then a new roster comes on board. We are currently in the midst of recruiting the open vacancies that are on that group. But from this meeting, the April 13th meeting, there are three pieces that came out of that were pertinent to this conversation. The first was in regards to this idea about whether state regulation is consistent with federal law about waterfowl hunting over flooded, unharvested crop. There was unanimous support that this is legal. There is nothing about a legal aspect of that that is in question. The second one that came out of that was more of a guidance or a directive from the advisory group to kind of inform this conversation, that the department should support a variety of food resources for habitat management, and that best management practice should include food crops and moist soil management. That was met with a 13-1 support. Something worth noting is that this group has two responsibilities. One is in terms of regulatory, but the other is in terms of the duck stamp revenue, the migratory bird permit. Every waterfowl hunter in the state buys a migratory bird permit, and that revenue goes into an account that must go back to wetland work on the ground, and primarily it goes to public land wetland uses. There are occasions where it goes onto private land, but the private land would have to allow a public access component for that fund to be used, and that's in that legislative guidance that revolves around that that fund. So it's important to note that this group is reviews a lot of all the project proposals that come in every biennium related to habitat work on the ground, and so that all hunters, regardless of whether they're public or private hunting, are contributing to funds that go back to wetland conservation in Washington and primarily on public lands. And finally, the last sort of consistent conversation piece that was at that meeting was about data. Any decision should be informed with appropriate data to assess the potential influence these types of practices may be having on waterfowl in Washington. What's important to point out here is that in Washington, this particular topic specifically revolves around mallard. Washington is in a unique situation where mallards are a overwhelming component of the bag. In some years, over 50% of the total harvest is in mallard, as opposed to other states where if they get 10% mallard, that's a good year. That's important because from a regulatory standpoint, mallard are what guide the overall bounds on the season frameworks. We go to great lengths to conduct annual surveys every breeding season. These are often called the BPOP surveys. There are surveys that are going on through Canada and Alaska, but we also conduct our own here in Washington, and Oregon and California also conduct their own. And this is primarily to track mallard. It is true that breeding pairs of mallards are at all-time high since recording in 1955. That does not mean that there's not certain concerns. There are certain areas that seem to have questionable breeding status in them, particularly in southern Alberta, which has historically fed a huge component of mallard into our state in terms of harvest. The other way that we're able to track that is through some of the operational, what's termed operational preseason banding, banding birds. Mallard is the primary bird that we band, and that data does go back into the adaptive harvest management model used nationwide and specifically for the Western mallard stock to inform whether or not there's some sort of concern about overall survival and particularly in relation to mallard. So those data set this framework that serves as a check on the system. If there was something going wrong with mallard, there would be restrictions on the actual season lengths and bag limits that would be allowed within each state. Since the inception of the adaptive harvest management model in 1996, we have always been in a liberal option, meaning the full 107 days and the full bag limit being potentially comprised of mallard.
Commissioner Thorburn?
Yeah.
You got it with the earlier presentation. I did want to ask about mallard because you bring it up as the limiting factor each time you provide our season setting presentation. So we banned, I guess I'll start with the concern is the mallard that are feeding the flyway. We must have a lot of resident mallards, though. So we're banding to contribute data. How does that impact this information about the mallards that are the limiting factor? And why do mallards remain the limiting factor when we're hearing about pintails in our flyway?
Those are good questions, and I could provide a whole day's briefing on that. The quick answer is we now live in what is called the Western Mallard Model. That leverages Alaska-reared mallards with those that are reared in the southern regions, such as British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and California. That is why we continue to do our aerial surveys during the summers to track breeding pair numbers. But the banding banding occurs in all of those areas, including into Canada and the prairie potholes. You're right. Our harvest is a mixture of mallards from everywhere. A mallard looks like a mallard, except for we know when in our state in particular, mallard harvest is comprised of birds coming from Alberta, Saskatchewan, British Columbia, Northwest Territories, Alaska, and certainly in state. To try and tease that out is certainly difficult, but the banding data allows us an opportunity to say, is there one part of that system that's going better or worse than another? And that's where that inference about during the 70s, southern Alberta contributed a much higher proportion to the harvest than what we're seeing currently. But that is tied to breeding habitat conditions and concerns about nesting habitat and that sort of thing, not related to harvest being the contributing factor of decline. But I can certainly provide a lot more information on that, but I'm going to stop there.
The second part is, why do mallards remain the limiting factor?
And so, a duck that's and it's because of their distribution, both in terms of their breeding distribution. They're widely distributed. They're occupying many different habitats, including far northern latitudes like Alaska. But also because of their breadth in the harvest. I mentioned that in certain years, our total harvest of water ducks in Washington can exceed 400,000, and 200,000 of that could be mallard. That's a very unique situation, and that's some sort of composition of those different breeding stocks coming in. It's hard for us to know that, except to look at some of the banding data. But there is certainly concern about breeding habitat topics, nesting habitats, brood rearing habitats, even here in Washington, that I think gets masked by that overall look, right? But we don't have data to that kind of specificity. It would take a tremendous effort to get there. It's not impossible, but that's certainly That's where the other piece to mention about that that duck stamp revenue account, in that legislative guidance, it is actually specified that in the eastern Washington, the habitat that is supposed to be encouraged is more targeted towards recruitment and breeding season type habitats, as opposed to some of the wintering habitats in western Washington.
Thank you.
So I'll leave it on this. It is complex. Migratory birds have this annual conundrum that they're seeking a balance between food, water, and refuge along their annual flyway movement. And in the case of here in Washington, that can include birds coming from Alaska to Canada and certainly throughout the state. But I'll leave it in terms of this. I'll leave it to the textbook to actually close with this quote. Overall, quality habitat, abundant and available, is unequivocally the most important ecological component affecting populations of waterfowl. Management can, however, be especially effective in synchronizing the abundance, availability, and spatial distribution of food, cover, and water resources to coincide with specific events in the life history of the waterfowl. I guess the last thing I would say is that Washington is also in a unique aspect that we have year-round mandates in terms of habitat availability on the landscape. So while often some of the conversations are focused on October through January, as you heard earlier today, it's not only that that time period is important for us to ensure that there's food and refuge on the ground, and that certainly can't be accomplished with public land only or private land only. It is through that sort of partnership and those activities on both sides, both state and federal lands, but also to mention that it is not just waterfowl, as was earlier mentioned. Some of that forage crop is also for other species, such as cranes moving back through the area. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
You did well. You got within 3 minutes of the window.
Okay.
Huh?
All right.
Any
I'll take that.
To the left? No? Questions to the right? Seeing none. Kyle, thank you very much. Okay. Have a safe trip home.
Thank you very much.